Welcome to Public Health Matters with Dr. Christina M. Madison, the founder and CEO of the Public Health Pharmacist, PLLC, a public health consulting firm. She is passionate about spreading knowledge on public health in order to create healthier and happier communities.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Public Health Matters with your host, me, Dr. Christina Madison, also known as the Public Health Pharmacist. I have an extraordinary guest today, Dr. Richard Ferguson, who I feel very fortunate to know and call both a colleague and a friend. I'm super excited to chat with him about some very, what I would consider to be impactful topics around public health and health equity, and then also something else that's near and dear to my heart, which is maternal mortality. So with that, I would love to have Dr. Ferguson go ahead and say a little bit about himself and where he's currently practicing and all of the many hats that he wears and his advocacy work. So welcome, Dr. Ferguson.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Happy to have this chance for us to discuss some matters that will be not only relevant to my now new hometown of Salt Lake City, Utah, but those that will apply to many, professionals across this nation. So, yeah, I am originally from Washington, D.C., but have made Salt Lake City my home for about the last 10 and a half to 11 years. Went out there to finish a residency in family medicine, but pretty much have not done any continuity of care since graduating and have been an emergency medicine provider, physician, pretty much since 2012. I'm actually about an hour and 20 minutes away from starting my ED shift up here in Northern Minnesota. And that's one of my hats. My day job that I still actually do while between patients while in the ER here is as a chief medical officer for a health plan, a small dual SNP. So that's a Medicaid, Medicare plan, often for special needs individuals and traditional Medicaid and integrated members in Utah. So we have about 36,000 members at this time. So out of the four accountable care organizations, we're the smallest, but I'd like to say the mightiest because we're more nimble and we can more quickly change to meet the needs of our members. And then my other hat is my organization, a nonprofit I developed to address underrepresentation of Black providers or Black physicians within Utah itself. We're only about 0.06% of all doctors there. So that comes out to about 41 to 43 physicians, depending on which year you're looking at, to address health inequities. So I believe representation matters. I take that very strongly. I see the difference it makes, and it will relate for even further on to the conversation topic of Black maternal mortality later. I hope that's me in a nutshell. I also love to do triathlons.
You were instrumental in getting COVID-19 vaccines out to your community, and that's actually how we know each other because of a connection with an organization called Wellness and Equity Alliance, which was previously Curative Medical. So, yeah. So, I mean, I think you, you're doing the work and you're showing up. And I think, you know, a lot of times the stress of the job gets to the point where we just, you know, continuously do the day-to-day. But what I love about what you're doing is that you're really trying to reach back and to pull up the next generation of healthcare professionals. So with that being said, I would love to talk a little bit about some of your mentorship work and how you see that integrating into sort of the concept around interprofessional care and how you engage other healthcare professionals, because I know your mentorship doesn't just solely focus on physicians, but also other members of the allied health professional team.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. Due to part of my community outreach and education side of Black Physicians of Utah, we were recent at several Juneteenth fairs over the last weekend or this past Monday, And one of the, a third year or rising senior came up to the table and says, I'm interested more in trying to do activities with BPOU. I love what you're about, your mission, your value of lifting the Black community, help increasing health literacy. She's like, but I really don't want to do anything clinical. I already know at this point that I don't want to get involved with that. But she's like, I'm interested in trying to change the system because the system failed me. And so she had a strong interest in MHA or getting a master's in health administration. And so I think right now she's trying to get an undergrad degree in health and social policy that's offered at some institutions, University of Utah, I think Western Governors University. I think that's where she's a senior at. And she said, how can I get mentorship into this space? I'm like, well, luckily I'm one of the, probably the only Black doc that happens to be in an admin position, like truly admin. Like my day-to-day job is non-clinical when I'm in Utah, you know, getting my W-2. And so I told her, I said, I definitely can help you out with that. I may not be the best, but I can definitely get you to one of my executive directors, which would, they would welcome you. And actually that would be a good way to possibly set up someone to success into our company. And because right now I'm the only Black employee at Health Choice Utah out of like 83 people. It's small and we're across multiple state lines, but I was like, this would be one great chance to change. So I've already set her up with a mentor, which will be my clinical network services RN. I, of course, will kind of facilitate that to make sure she's getting her needs met. Hey, are they checking in with you every 2 weeks? So she can right now, because she's at this crux that I'm sure you had to deal with as well, Dr. Madsen, with she's trying to decide between an MHA and an MPH. And so I'm also going to put her with our community outreach arm of our health plan so she can get some experience there just volunteering and hopefully to get her a part-time job that I'm trying to develop for multiple students within the health plan so that they can at least make a little bit of money, but it understand a little bit of population health, some of this mechanism of, you know, I like to sometimes see health insurance as the devil you have to deal with. You know, it's unfortunate it's here, but if it's going to be here, let's at least do our best so it works for people and not to just be a barrier as it's often seen and can be at many times. But also, any student I pretty much don't say no to if you're interested in health field. If you're not, I still have peers in my space. I'm like, oh, you're just interested in engineering? I know somebody that can help you with that. Oh, you're interested in nursing? I know MPs that can direct you and mentor you. But I still try to keep with my goal of we need more doctors because our number, especially male physicians, has not changed in decades percent wise of our representation. So mentorship, I try to focus right now in undergrad, hoping to go to seniors in high school by this fall. And much of that is just bandwidth. You know, I want to do a good job and make sure that my mentors are available for students to be able to meet with them every 2 weeks or a month, as opposed to, yeah, we're going to cast it open all the way to freshman year, all Black students within multiple counties. Well, that'll lead to frustration. A lot of students probably not getting follow-up response to emails until I get enough mentors.
The devil you know is sometimes better than the devil you don't know. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I totally appreciate that. As someone who used to work in managed care many, many, many eons ago, I think that the only way that you can fix the system is by being inside it, right? So I completely agree with that. And then, you know, with the mentorship, it is, you know, about quality. And so I would much rather, you know, do quality mentorship than just try to like spread myself too thin and have multiple people. So I'm very selective, I should say, about like who I choose to mentor. I never turn anybody away, but obviously, like you said, you know, if I have someone else that can maybe help them, I will refer them, but I don't ever want people to feel like that I'm the end all, right? Like I obviously have a very unique path. You know, the fact that many pharmacists, you know, really think that there's either hospital or community. That's like the two options, but a lot of pharmacists don't realize that they could go into a health plan, which I know that you lean very heavily on your pharmacist, that you have and you've spoken very highly of her. So I think that's fantastic. And then making sure that, you know, that we, that we're the example that we want our, you know, our younger colleagues to see. And I think the fact that you're still working in your non-W-2 as a clinician, I think is really important, because that's the other piece is, you know, once you get into administration, you get so far removed from the work that it makes it more difficult for you to see the forest through the trees. And mm-hmm. that's the one thing I've noticed a lot, is that once people get beyond that point, they forget where they came from. Right. Mm-hmm. And they forget the struggles of the day to day. And I deal a lot with this with pharmacists who complain about the laws changing. Right. So, and I know you know the impact of legislation as well, because this is what makes the world turn. Right. You know, you can complain about things all day, but if there's nothing on the books that says that you have to do it, it's not going to get done. Right. Mm-hmm. So rules and regulation is how things are managed, but you can't complain about the system and then not show up to be part of the discussion. So when I hear pharmacists complaining about these things, it's like, do you go to Board of Pharmacy meetings? Do you show up? Do you go to your state associations and advocate for change and things that you want to see? Because it doesn't trickle down. It trickles up. You have to show up or else it's never going to get done. So
that's kind of why I developed the group. I could just whine and complain and have listened to people say, well, just move to a city where there's more Black doctors. Well, or I could create a place that's welcoming for Black doctors to feel that they can thrive, as I felt I had. And I agree with you. We have a small little legislative mission that we're on as well with BPOU. Every February when our legislators meet in Utah, I tell everyone, reach out to your local, which is kind of new because the doctor's like, I'm already so busy. I'm like, hey, here's a form letter. It's at least so they know, and tell them you're with Black Physicians of Utah. That will probably put that in the header, and then they'll more likely read that email and respond to you. But I think more importantly is if we could either keep whining about what the state isn't doing, I'm like, oh, it's a Republican state, it's not going to listen to me. I'm like, you don't think when they're making legislation that affects healthcare or that could lead to affecting healthcare outcomes that you weren't there, you didn't give your opinion, you didn't speak up to your representative that was on that Health and Human Services Committee. They do want your input, but there's going to be someone else that's probably louder, maybe more conservative, that gets there before you. So let's stop the excuses. And I'm real big on that. That mantra, if you want it done right, you got to do it yourself, but at least give people the opportunity and the place, or at least the platform, which I felt I've created now, for where they can affect change or at least speak to it.
Absolutely. So with that being said, the next topic I really want to touch on and chat with you about is your work within maternal mortality and awareness around, in particular, women of color and obviously Black women being disproportionately impacted by, higher mortality rates, and not just the fact that it's, you know, related to social determinants of health, but in particular, it's structural racism and the way that our medical system was founded. So, you know, a lot of people may not realize that modern obstetrician and gynecology is actually formed on the backs of enslaved women. And a majority of the things that we know about gynecology is based on, the torture and experimentation on enslaved women. It unfortunately is still permeating through the system and is still to some degree being taught in medical education, which I am actively wanting to discuss and talk about and address issues around historical trauma and why there may be some mistrust and why we should be thinking about alternatives like doulas and how we can have people to come in and advocate for Black mothers, because they need to be heard. And unfortunately are not listened to. And I have my own pregnancy / delivery related trauma story where I wasn't believed and ended up being hospitalized after the birth of my second child. So,
yeah, no. So that is something that, you know, it's not as though it started from my mother's experience and saying she had a complicated outcome with myself or my sister. It came from just really hearing the stories, not so much in popular media, but in the Black mothers around me in Utah, when I would go back home to the DC area and hear about folks with significant blood loss, or I was having headaches or prior to delivery. And they just said, all right, let's just check your urine. All right, no protein, but didn't check her blood pressure. And they were sometimes going to facilities where I think sometimes the quality of care might not have been the best, because they're being run by overwhelmed residency staff that didn't get a sufficient supervision. And so it's not like I think we have to understand there's some archaicness that's to our medical training system that has to modernize to better advocate for our patients. And sometimes where it's not set up for that way, particularly OB-GYN as a specialty. Not to do anything to diss on my OB-GYN colleagues, the work they do is very good and very much needed. But OB-GYNs see pregnancy as something that needs to be fixed, we're surgeons, we want it, which also explains sometimes the higher C-section rate. They're very scared of, well, I got to prevent this outcome. There's a decel occurring. There's a lot that's taught, but they are more focused on, I need to fix something, as opposed to seeing pregnancy as a natural process, which you often have with your nurse practitioner midwife, where you're often going to receive a better outcome in someone that doesn't start off with complications in their pregnancy. And then sometimes it can vary a little bit with the experience level, but a midwife often can be much better than having an OB-GYN to take you through your pregnancy. And then we also know that outcomes don't worsen with having a doula. So that's someone that is, I would almost say, a lay professional that is there to echo and speak up for the woman during the, you know, before delivery and thereafter in postpartum care. So some of my work right now is trying to get insurance to cover that, because a lot of women don't even know what doulas are, particularly minority women, Black women, Latinos are like, what's a doula? They hear about it with, like a Gwyneth Paltrow, and she raves about her doula on her podcast. We're talking about it on a talk show or The View. And it's something that white women often have access to in Utah. But I think if even those that have private insurance, if they knew about it, they would take advantage of it. So kind of increasing awareness that it can improve the outcome if you sometimes shift a little bit away from the standard practice of delivery, which is, I got to have an OB-GYN at all times. And that's not necessarily the case. But and also trying to increase a little bit with patient empowerment so that they know that, so they can do a little bit more to bring someone with them to a visit, so they don't have to feel sometimes so isolated and alone. It's a very scary time. As someone that can never get pregnant, it's a very scary time. And women sometimes don't know that they may have options when it comes to treatment or follow-up for a particular condition. So that's one thing that I'm doing. But the other big thing is just trying to get increased access to care for Black women, because if you're insured, you're more likely to have prenatal care. And it's even worse for Native American women. So I don't even speak to them. I don't even speak about that sometimes as often. As an example, a woman that was a multip, had more than one pregnancy, she came in and she just felt constipated. And I could see that she was at least 7 months. And I was just walking out while the nurse was going to get fetal heart tones. She's like, I really got to go to the bathroom. And then minutes later, I hear the alarm and I'm rushing out in the hallway and the baby's in the toilet. This is just 2 days ago. And she had no prenatal care at all. Luckily, baby went off to the hospital okay, had hair, I believe nails, wrapped it up, sent it on. But that you can imagine, mind you, that's a bit of, and it's not as unusual occurrence as you might think of people coming in with no prenatal care getting ready to deliver. Luckily, she was overall healthy. So you're right. Addressing social determinants of health, part of that is health insurance access. And then making trying to change providers, change their approach to pregnant women, to listening, particularly to women of color, to try to undo some of those systemic effects. Because you have to remember, we were seen as, you know, often coming from plantations and after leaving slavery, is seen as subhuman. In some many aspects of society, Black folks are still seen as other or less than human by sometimes how we're treated by police brutality. So are seen as though having less sensitivity to pain, being more stoic, our children appearing older and often more resistant to pain. Even our children aren't offered pain medication as fast as white children when it comes to an emergent setting. So these are things that some of my non-BIPOC colleagues still aren't aware of. So I'm trying to push that teaching forward, but at the same time say, there are solutions to this. And you can be more culturally aware when someone comes in a room, because we're not going to be able to do all this as just Black providers.
We're talking about doulas, because that is something that I didn't know about and wish I had known about before I had my children, because I do feel that oftentimes women, in particular Black women, are not listened to and are not heard. So there's two different programs that I've spoken about. So the CDC has a Hear Her program that is really focused on awareness around listening to and believing women, and in particular Black women, because of, you know, the things that you just mentioned about, you know, this preconceived notion that our skin is thicker, we don't experience pain as much, we're able to, you know, somehow, you know, we're just able to handle everything, right? We're strong
Black women. Or that we're seeking.
Or that were drug seeking, which is what happened to me. Yeah. So I had to be, I had to go to the emergency room twice before I was admitted and ended up with in sepsis and had, you know, elevated cardiac enzymes. And they thought that I had postpartum cardiomyopathy and they thought I was drug seeking, but in reality, I was having, you know, I had two C-sections. The second C-section, I ended up with complications and ended up being septic. But like, that's the thing, like literally the only difference between the first and the second time I went to the ER was that the first provider that saw me was a white male and the second one wasn't. It was a man of color. He was South Asian, but he believed me. He asked me questions. He said, what makes it better? What makes it worse? When did it start? Like asked me all these questions and like was very responsive to my needs and was like, let's get some tests. I think we need to admit you. And that man's probably saved my life. Mm. So, and I'm very, and it's, you know, my child is four and it's taken me many, many years of dealing with that trauma and dealing like with the guilt of being a healthcare professional, having a doctorate and still not being able to advocate for myself and to not blame myself for that, but really acknowledging that it had nothing to do with all of those letters behind my name and all my credentialing and all my education. It literally was the fact that I woke up Black that morning.
Yeah. And it you're just, in a hospital gown, that's all they see.
That's it. That's it. That's literally it. And it's taken me years to get to the point to be able to talk about it and not like start crying, because it like, you know, if I think back about it and like, you know, my poor husband would have been left with a 7 week old and a not even 2 year old and would have been, you know, a widower, you know? So like, but this scenario is happening at an alarming rate and we're not talking about it. I know during the pandemic, there was a Black pediatrician who passed away. And it was postpartum complications and she had, I believe she had undiagnosed preeclampsia. But again, the other thing, like they check protein in the urine, but then they don't check your blood pressure, which is crazy to me. Like, why would you not check the person's blood pressure? Right. Like we know that these are the things that impact our Black mothers more. So why are we not looking for these things versus just making excuses for people having a headache? Or, you know, I had a scenario where there was a Hispanic woman here in Las Vegas when I used to work at the health department, and she had a cough for many, many months. And the OB said, oh, it's a pregnancy cough. When have you ever heard of a pregnancy cough in your entire life? Never, never, never. Right. Turned out this, that she had family that came and visited from Mexico and brought unpasteurized cheese and milk, and it was M. bovis. So she actually had been infected with tuberculosis during her pregnancy, and nobody checked her. But then by the time had twins, underwent IVF, all of the things that put you at risk, but nobody checked her, and then said she had a pregnancy cough, and then ended up exposing an entire NICU because mom was coughing and was visiting
the whole time. Babies.
Yep. And then she ended up having to be flown to UCLA to get additional care, ended up passing, both the babies passed, but it was like, it could have been prevented. And it was because, like, literally the system failed her.
It would take a skilled doc, I think, because TB is not endemic here, and they probably just didn't ask enough questions in a history. It's because that cough probably was there for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it definitely can happen. So that's something that whenever I have a med student that occasionally rotates with me, but also my pre-meds, when we start to present particular specialties, we go in on how to do a proper history. Because as I tell many of them, 90% of the time, the patient will tell you what's wrong with them, and you won't need all these studies and tests, which I think sometimes makes the difference between an astute physician and a mid-level that, you know, didn't have as many hours of training. So they're immediately ordering a CT scan, but yet hasn't done a pelvic exam because they haven't done that many in their training. So, but mind you, there's docs that are doing the same thing, either because of our system doesn't allow time to examine people, and then we're measured on metrics on what's your throughput, and seeing people as kind of these just bodies that we're trying to push through a system. And that's often where quantum, but yet are more and more of our reimbursement will be tagged to quality of care from these surveys or outcomes that people have. And it's, you know, but wanting to become a physician today doesn't have a lot of glamour associated with it, unless you're going to one of the soft specialties, I'd like to say, like a derm, or that sounds very nice, or
yes, you know, and you can do fillers and all of the aesthetic things. I have many colleagues that do that work.
Yeah, but that's not meeting the needs really of the community. Vanity. I call that a vanity specialist. Mind you, we need skin cancer treated. Do not get me wrong. We need melanoma addressed. We need more Black dermatologists. Don't get me wrong on that. We just lost one in Utah. She moved to Montana. I was like, oh, wow, you went to an even whiter state. Okay.
Oh my goodness.
That's what marriage will do.
Because
of her husband's up there.
Oh man. Yeah, no. So, I mean, I absolutely love the work that you're doing, and I think it's so important, and just really want to acknowledge that, you know, you are meeting a need that is a giant need, right? So, you know, you use the expression, how do you eat an elephant, right? Bite by bite, small bites. And I think you're doing that. You're addressing this larger issue, but I think, you know, getting some of that media coverage and getting some of those, you know, the features talking about the impacts that you've been able to make, I think is really important as well, because, you know, we can do the good work all day, but if nobody sees it, how can it be emulated? How can it be reproduced? How can we scale? Right.
Actually, I wanted to go, some people are like, oh, well, we can start doing this for nurses. I'm like, hey, nurses have got their own associations for a while and they outnumber docs. There's a path for them. Yes, I care about Black nurses in Utah. I said, but how about maybe, you know, we're a really small population. We represent about 1.9 to 2% of the total population, which is why sometimes we don't see the great disparities and inequities occurring with outcomes, particularly even when we saw with the effects of COVID admissions and illness within the state. Now, we did see the vaccine hesitancy that we saw represented in the African-American community throughout the nation, but we didn't see increased hospitalizations and death associated with the Black community in Utah, because it's not really until you get past about 10% of a population that you start to see the disparities. So there's just not enough there yet. But my Latino and Polynesian brothers and sisters, they definitely did feel a big brunt of those, of the COVID pandemic and a subsequent morbidity that was associated with it, with those infections. And so I sometimes like to say, I would love there to be a Latino physicians of Utah, Polynesian physicians of Utah. And some people will then say, well, that's too divisive. Now you've got all these separate little groups. And I'm like, we can eventually all do efforts and work together. So much, some, you know, I have to say probably about 10 or 15% of my work is in Spanish speaking populations, Latino immigrant and Latino American group populations within Utah, because they see me, they hear me. They see a person of color that's in their neighborhood speaking to the, you know, often many similar health conditions that are common in both Black and Latino communities. I can speak to both. I just can't speak Spanish, but I can get some material there. And it's a trusted face that is trying to provide the same message. But I know we're kind of outnumbered 4-1 by Latino providers. And so my next thing would be, I would love to model this, what I'm doing with the Latino physicians, which I know there, I have a few colleagues that want to do it, but it's really kind of the, are they going to make the time to do it? I'm more about just education. I'm really big on action because I don't like just talking all day. Show me that you're trying to make change. Don't window dress with your DEI committee and your health system that's made of a majority white women that are talking about the problem. What are you going to do about hiring? You know, that's one thing that's important also to BPOU, hiring, retention, diversifying your workforce. Because just like in business, diversification of the workforce improves your bottom line. You are more profitable. And it's just like care outcomes improve as well.
I mean, I completely agree with everything that you said. I mean, it's so interesting because I forget that in Utah, you guys have a very large AAPI community as well, because in particular, the you know, Polynesian and Samoan community is very much in the Mormon faith. So I was actually just in Hawaii, which we were talking about, and you know, there's BYU Hawaii, and there's a lot of, you know, people that are from like Micronesia and, you know, Polynesia, and a lot of the things that bring them together and why they end up moving to Utah is because of the Mormon faith. And so I do sometimes forget that there is a large AAPI community as well. And then, you know, our Indigenous brothers and sisters, which are also very disproportionately impacted, we need to think about them as well. But I mean, I think the through line for all of this is that we need to have, you know, first and foremost, better communication. So the healthcare communication and the health literacy side, I think, is extraordinarily important. But that piece only works when you have a messenger that is reflective of the communities that they serve, which is why I think that the work that you're doing is so important, because we need to have more healthcare professionals that look like the communities that they serve. And when you cross that barrier, you see drastically better outcomes. You know, if I see someone who looks and sounds like me, I'm much more likely to take their recommendation because they know about my lived experience. You know, I work with a large LGBTQ population, and you know, some of the times they're like, oh, you know, what does a cisgender heterosexual Black woman know about my struggles? And I'm like, I woke up Black this morning. I know all about your struggles, you know, like. So like, we can all be allies, but you still need people to show up and look like you, or at least have some form of a lived experience that is reflective of how you see yourself in the world.
And there are allies to my organization, because I also know that I'm not going to be able to reach all these students, especially as I start to grow into Weber State University, now that we're growing into BYU, where I'm trying to start small chapters of Black pre-med societies at these institutions so that these students kind of feel they have a home together as they go on this journey to become physicians, which is often long. There's a lot of tests there, they can be with peers that are trying to avoid some of the distractions so they can stay on this path, but also where they can create opportunities where now faculty can access them and like, oh, would you like to work in my lab? Oh, would you like this position as a medical assistant with my wife or, adjunct faculty that I know off campus? Now we've created a place where these Black students are able to come together and build on these educational resources all at the same time. So when I look at that, I see that there is a path, but I know that there's only about, like I said, about 40 docs. And just because you're Black, you can't assume that everybody believes or is as passionate as I am. So that's another thing where people are like, oh, well, you've got enough doctors. Well, they've got families and they've got their lives. They may not have the 2 hours or believe as much in your cause. And so, but I do have Latino providers, have, quite a few white providers. Like, I want to help. Tell me how I can help. What's the best way? This has been needed for so many years. I want there to be more Black students in this residency program. I want there to be more Black doctors here. What can I do? How can I help? So I want that person on our team because we won't be able to do it just as me being the sole messenger all the time, because I have a life. I want to be able to do some things, but luckily I have a very understanding fiance, and she understands how important this work is, so that we can kind of change the face of Utah. Of its healthcare workforce. So that's kind of my next bigger thing, is not only just physicians, but them all allied fields, and we diversify and then get funding for the state to better address it. But yeah, if you go on my page and you look at allied preceptors, these are my non-Black physicians that are on there wanting to do the good work. And they reach, I gate pretty much after every health fair. I have people walking up saying, how can I be a mentor? I'm willing to take a student under me. They're usually coming from elsewhere. They're not from Utah. When you come from outside of Utah, you realize when you come here, even the white folks are like, wow, there are no people of color in my department. Or I haven't seen a Black doctor in months, or I haven't seen one since I've been here. And then when they notice and then reach out to me, that's when you know there's a problem. And it's like, Utah, you are behind. You need to make a change. So I had an anesthesiologist that came up to me on the Juneteenth with his two little white girls. He's like, I finished residency here 6 years ago and I want to make a change. So what do I need to do? Where can I sign up? And I'm like, here's an application to be a mentor.
That's fantastic. I know you're looking at reaching out to the dental programs as well. So dental, and then also we talked about pharmacy to bring people into the organization. Mm-hmm. And so, that's definitely something that you and I are working towards because of my connection with Roseman and the fact that we have a huge program in South Jordan. So I think there are many ways that we can make an impact, and I'm so grateful for your your work and everything that you're doing and your inclusivity of all allied health professionals. And I think that's, we need more of that. And I am hopeful that we will continue to collaborate, to highlight ways that physicians, pharmacists, nurse practitioners, PAs, everyone within the healthcare space, because it's going to take an army to really get people better care and to really work on, population health, social determinants of health, health disparities, and most importantly, health equity, right? And the concept around the fact that the playing field is not level for everyone, and that we need to create an environment where things are just and people have access to not just care, but quality care. And I'm really looking forward to the work that you're continuing to do and seeing you change the face of healthcare in Utah.
Oh yeah, I'm excited to do it. My next big thing will probably be our Medicine Immersion Day, where I'm gonna open it to 8 seniors in high school and undergrad that are pre-meds or interested in medicine, about 50 students. We're going to start small, We're going to do it at a community hospital. I also like supporting community hospital because that's where I pretty much got, you know, cut my teeth when in emergency medicine, and where I continue to practice today. There often sometimes can be shadow in the shadows of a big tertiary or quaternary care facility, and they get no love. But they are vital to many communities, because when you're remote or rural access, they need quality physicians and providers. And so I'm using a hospital in Sandy, Utah, and we're going to have a day where this is a life as a doctor. And we're going to have some of that's going to be supported by my Black physician members, but also some of my allied members. And throughout the day, we're going to spend time with small groups and take them through hands-on simulations. And we're also going to do things where they visit an OR suite, get talked to by a general surgeon. Then they're going to do a kind of a little case study based on one of the body systems. Then we're going to kind of close out with a cadaver lab. So I'm really excited about that. That'll probably occur in September. And then the next big thing will be a health and fitness campaign, because I feel addressing obesity within the Black community is important. And I want it to not just be a one and done with this sort of walk run that I want to do. I want to make sure that a grocery store is present, because we know about food deserts. And often when you are finishing, if you ever, anybody that's listening that's done a 5K run walk, you may see a nutrition store there, maybe. But most of the time, people aren't getting things from a nutrition store. One, they're priced out. They're out of people's price range. But they're going to the grocery store. But the grocery stores are usually not present at a race. And this is where people are going afterwards. So I would like nutritionists, dietitians there from the local community, particularly the University of Utah. And not only by providing education classes to people as prizes, nutrition classes as prizes, but also, hey, this is how you can, someone that's a professional shopper, to say, this is where you can go. This is what you need to look at to better understand what you're seeing at the grocery store. So I'm hoping that will take off well in the fall. But yeah, no, Dr. Madsen, this is something that will not end with me. And I'm hoping there will be more and more docs like me that want to take up this call, particularly with my mentees right now. I hopefully they will take over in 3 or 4 years and continue this work.
Well, this has been such an inspiring and delightful conversation, Dr. Ferguson. If people want to find you or want to reach out to you and see more about your journey, where can they find you, get in touch with you, or see what you're doing online?
Yeah, I think the best thing, I post a lot on LinkedIn. So if you just type in Richard Ferguson, Health Choice Utah, I'll probably come up right there. But also you can, I regularly update our website. So bpou.org. If you just type that in, go to our events page, see our home slider, and there's a contact form there that will send an email directly to info@bpou.org. Also, feel free to subscribe to our YouTube channel, Black Physicians of Utah. I'm going to be putting up a new video on dispelling the myths on how our grandmas and moms and dads say, Black don't crack, you don't need any sunscreen. Well, I have a big little video. I have a little video that's coming out soon that's going to encourage Black folks or people of color why it's important to protect your skin in the summer. So, go to our YouTube channel and our Instagram as well. We put out quite a bit of material. And if you come to Utah, feel free to stop by at one of our events.
Fantastic. Thank you so much again. This has been such an important conversation, and I hope our listeners take away some key points and start dialogue in their own communities. So with that being said, I am your host again, Dr. Christina Madsen. You can find me at the Public Health Pharmacist on your social media du jour of choice, or you can also find me on LinkedIn as well. I'm connected to Dr. Ferguson. And remember, public health matters.
Stay safe, be well, and remember, public health matters.